There's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores.
I think I'm a farmer deep down at heart. I wanted a family endeavor.
It's not about what someone else says. It's not about what rating it got. It's about what you enjoy drinking.
Wine to start with is something that is social.
It's about networking. It's about calling up people and ask for advice. And everybody's willing to help out.
Consumer wants something that's uncomplicated about wine. Why do you want one more thing to worry about?
I would trade this for nothing. It is my life and it is my dream.
You know, you only get to make one wine a year. It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know. It's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle. And welcome to our 59th podcast, May 2012. This month, we feature Watermark wine owner and winemaker, Phil Steinschreiber from Calistoga.
For over 25 years, Phil Steinschreiber has made some of the most sought-after wine in Napa Valley. In 2004, he started his own project called Watermark. Take my word for it, a wine very much worth seeking out. We visited Phil at his home in Calistoga, which includes a bonded winery in his garage. A special thanks to Tim Mertz of A Dozen Vintners on Highway 29 in Napa Valley for his help in setting up this interview. I am here at the home of Phil Steinschreiber, and Phil is the winemaker and vineyard manager at Diamond Creek Wines.
Correct.
So, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's a lovely day. Unfortunately, we're not getting enough rain.
And that's the thing I've been hearing all along. So, what do you think? I mean, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but...
Well, this is one of the reasons why I was late for this interview. I had to discuss it with some of the employees because I've decided to start irrigating. And because we've had such a lack of rain, we've had only little less than 14 inches of rain. And for us, that's like Southern California, just about. And for us, we like to have the ground saturated before bud break. So we will start having an irrigation regime of about one full day for each portion of the vineyard. And that will give us anywhere from 12 to 24 gallons for each vine. And if it doesn't rain within the next couple of weeks, we're going to do it again.
How often do you have to irrigate?
This is the first time that we've done it in a long time during winter. But if you mean irrigation during growth season, it varies depending on the weather. When it's very hot, obviously, we irrigate more. When it's cooler, we irrigate less.
As compared to, say, 2011, which I'm going to guess you didn't do a whole heck of a lot of irrigating.
Not a lot.
I imagine.
No,
so.
No. And that was a challenging vintage.
Yeah, I can't imagine. The word challenging is sort of almost a euphemism to a degree.
Yes, that's for sure. It's the first time that I have ever seen rot in a on a Cabernet vine.
Really?
Yeah, first time. And I've been growing grapes now for 30 years. So it was a little scary. But we were up for the challenge and we took care of it. We sorted a lot and cut a lot of clusters out and did what we could. But I will guarantee you that I will not use 100% of my wine to go into the bottle.
What do you think? What would be a rough percentage of where you ended up?
I would say 50%.
That's a pretty big number.
That is a pretty big number.
Yes. I mean, if any business were to take their business and cut it in half, that's going to make a big difference when it comes down to paying bills.
Well, our reputation exceeds that. So we have to do what we have to do.
Right.
I will tell you this, that I harvested some grapes for my own, for Watermark, at the elevation of 2,000 feet. And there was zero rot in that one. And the reason, I believe, is that anything above the fog line did very well because the vines were not wet during the entire period. And as you probably know, it rained, but it didn't rain consistently across the 10 days after that. What it did do was we had ground fog and it just made everything wet. You can just go out there, you shake the vine and it just just water everywhere. Whereas at higher elevations, which was above the fog line and in the sun, got a chance to dry out. So that was a plus for me because I have some Mount Veeder grapes that are out of this world. So I'm looking forward to it.
That's funny. Who would expect something like that? But again, right, it's all affecting mostly the floor more than anything else.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So how long have you been a winemaker?
I actually started as a child. Like I said, my father had liquor stores. And I used to work in the stores, and lo and behold, there are all these wines, and not that I was drinking any, but...
of course not, God forbid.
I certainly was around it. And then I traveled to Europe in 74, and we were traveling through France and Italy, and I was in the back of a VW bus drinking gallons of wine and going through the vineyards, and I thought, God, this is beautiful. But I had no idea that I would end up going... being a winemaker. I came back and I went to work for my father in 1976 and started selling wine. So I got interested in more and more in wine and started studying to go back for my second degree to get my master's in enology. And graduated in 1983 with my master's from Fresno State and moved to Israel and started a winery in the Golan Heights. Was there for 2 years, came back to California, got a job in 1986 at a winery called Napa Creek Winery, and was there for 5 years, and finally Al succumbed. Actually, Al visited me in Israel in 1983, and who was the owner of Diamond Creek. Who was the owner? He passed away about 5-6 years ago now. And we got to know each other at that point. I came back and I kept bugging him about a job. And finally, one day he says, I think I have something for you. The rest is more or less history, as they say.
What made you decide to go to Israel to make wine?
It was offered to me. I'm Jewish, mm-hmm. and they wanted a Jewish winemaker to start a new winery in the Golan Heights with the California style. That's what they called it.
Why would they want California style?
They wanted to modernize.
Okay.
And they weren't. And they weren't known for wine. We were actually the impetus to all these new wineries today in Israel. I think there are something like 60 or 70 wineries.
And some of them are making some pretty good wine because I've tried some of them.
Exactly. And we were the first ones to bring what we call the California, the modernization of winemaking in Israel.
So that's the influence with these wines then?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And they're planting different varietals now and in the right places. Mm-hmm. We planted in the Golan Heights. It varies in elevation from minus, I think it's 600 feet, to plus 10,000. So you can almost pick and choose where you want to grow certain varieties. So you go a higher elevation for cooler varieties and lower elevation for warmer varieties.
So you were getting good results out of the lower elevations.
Absolutely.
That's interesting because when you hear people talk about valley floors and that kind of thing, it's like, well, this is well below that.
Well, I wasn't down to minus 600 feet.
No.
When we were talking about lower elevations, we're talking about 2,000 to 2,500.
Wow.
So it's still pretty high.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Well, and as a side for me, when I go to certain wine stores that have huge selections, I'll always want to try wines from different countries. And I've picked up a couple from Israel. Just, you know, just kind of like, okay, the price is reasonable. We'll give it a try.
Right.
You take it home and you're like, wow, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
So you started something.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the other reason I wanted to do something different
sure. In
the world. I think we all do. So it was fun.
And then you came back.
And then it came back and went to work like every other slob in this country.
Well put. And how long have you been at Diamond Creek again?
I've been at Diamond Creek for 21 years.
That's a pretty good record, I'd say.
Yeah. They bought me and they knew a good thing when they had it.
You're awfully shy. I don't know, Phil.
Absolutely. I'm very modest.
Well, and you make obviously a very spectacular wine, I have to say.
Yeah.
So, and now is Watermark a private project?
It is.
I should explain that Watermark wine is a wine I'm familiar with that is California wine that you make.
Right. Watermark is my own venture that I do, I guess you want to say, on the side. I ultimately would like to have my own vineyard and my own winery in my own space. But obviously in the Napa Valley, it's quite expensive to do so. So it takes a long time. And here I am at 60 years old and wonder if it will ever happen. So we hope it will. But in the meantime, I have to purchase grapes, which goes against my philosophy somewhat, because I believe that you should be in 100% in control of your grapes, your source, and in control of the winemaking.
Do you have input for the vineyards that you're leasing?
At Diamond Creek or my own?
No, I'm sorry, for...
For Watermark?
Right, yes.
Oh, yeah, I have input, okay. But not nearly the same as growing it yourself.
When I mentioned the one was Howell Mountain, which, you know, I'm a big fan of. And
right.
Where are these grapes sourced from?
These are sourced from several different places. Mostly, there's some valley floor and some... Actually, these come from right below Howell Mountain, and it's a blend.
Mm. You do a good job.
Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah. Are you crushing these at Diamond Creek then?
I actually make a lot of these wines at Rudy von Strasser's place.
Oh, really?
Von Strasser Winery.
Another great winery.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. They make great wine.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
he's a good company.
He's a good buddy. We play poker together.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Oh, wine there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I noticed you have a golf course in your backyard. I think golf is a great game, but it's overrated. I think you should look into making a vineyard back there. What do you think?
I would love to. You know, just got to have the county let me.
I can't even imagine. So, do you have any kind of philosophy? Do you have any kind of, you know, is there something that you're very specific about when you're making your wine?
Well, I believe, you know, this sounds very cliche, but I've been saying it forever. I do believe that the wine is made in the vineyard. We spend a lot of time out in the vineyards. We manicure them. We pull clusters. We de-leaf. We basically do cluster farming. Every cluster is on its own in its own little world, and we make sure that it's getting that the vine is getting what it needs. I try to have the clusters, the grapes as small as possible if I can, which means deficit irrigation in the beginning and then a little bit more irrigation later on to keep the vines going. But I don't like large vines. When we have wet years, unfortunately, that happens. And doesn't look like it will this year. And I do believe that we'll probably have a banner year this year if the weather cooperates during harvest, which it hasn't for the last several years.
No, it's been a rough time around here. This is the end of part one. Visit lifebetweenthevines.com to download part two of podcast number 59, our interview with Phil Steinschreiber of Watermark Wine.